This episode is brought to you by SendPro from Pitney Bowes. SendPro has three times the features of Stamps.com at one-third the price. Visit pb.com/geek to learn more and try it for free for 90 days. After that, you get SendPro for only $5 a month. That's pb.com/geek. And big thanks to HelloFresh.com for supporting Current Geek today as well. Receive $30 off your first week of deliveries when you go to HelloFresh.com and use the offer code CURRENTGEEK30. Remember, go to HelloFresh.com and use the offer code CURRENTGEEK30 to get $30 off your first week of deliveries on us. Thanks, HelloFresh.
I have
Current Geek!
Current Geek!
Hello, everybody, and welcome back to Current Geek, the weekly proceedings and the meetings of the Frog Pants All-Stars, geeks of the world and you, to keep you current and all things that matter most. I'm Scott Johnson with the one, the only, the Tom Merritt. Hello.
My only regret for today's episode, Scott, is that we are no longer in Utah together.
Oh, I feel like last time we had this conversation, it was right before. Now, of course, it's right after.
Yeah.
You guys don't understand. If you weren't there, it's a magical sandwich.
Man.
Yeah. It's hard to explain. Like this, today is bread. The show before this one was bread, but you should have seen the sandwich part.
Oh, yeah.
Oh.
That tasty, delicious mushroom for you vegetarians and or ham sandwich.
Yeah, it was really good. And it sadly did not include, we didn't do an official Current Geek podcast this year from the event. But
true.
Lots of nerdy stuff happened and you guys missed out. Sorry.
We kept current with our geekiness. So I think we kept the spirit alive.
That's true. And if you would like to go, I may as well get this out of the way up top. If you want to go see the raw video of all of the live events that we did there, they are all now delightfully and conveniently coagulated at the top of the nerdtacular.com page. So you can just go.
Is that the right word? Is that the word?
That's probably not the right word. Probably not. Maybe I'm thinking of blood. I'm thinking of blood. Whoops, I've done it again. But go there.
Is it a wound that is being stopped by these videos?
Okay. It's seeping. Maybe. It's a seeping wound. If you go there.
Seeping wound of our hearts after
exactly.
Leaving Snowbird.
It's a sad, sad day. But they're all there. You can watch them. You can have fun, even though you weren't there. But we have a guest with us, and he was there. So he had just as much fun. He knows of this sandwich of which I speak. It's Dave Fitzgerald. You know him as the Legal Geek. And a real-life patent attorney and all-around nerd. David, welcome to the show.
Hello, gentlemen. It's good to be on the main portion of the show, and I apologize to all the people who only listen live who have no idea who the heck I am. But for all you podcast listeners, welcome. You get more of me this week.
That's
so congratulations.
Right. Way more Dave than you know what to do with.
I mean, Dave's doing double duty. He's going to have a Legal Geek segment at the end of this episode.
Yeah. Not a live one. It'll all be in post. So
yeah.
So you at home, you already know what to expect. But it's awesome having you here. And it is, I have to say, a slightly weird hearing your voice out of that context. Just slightly. But
it's okay. I'll have good legal bits, I'm sure, at some point.
Oh, good. Because I'm going to have lots of legal questions. Because I'm not letting this opportunity go past us, Tom. He knows patent law. Like more than any guest we've ever had. So we talk a lot about properties and IPs and stuff on this show that happen to all have a lot of patent law around them. So
listen, I feel very, very good when Dave writes in and is like, Tom got it mostly right. Because I'm not trained to this stuff. So that's good.
Yeah.
It's good to hear when we actually don't mess it up too bad.
I agree. Well, let's see how far we can go without messing any of the following stories up.
Herbert Hoover, Secretary of Commerce in 1922, finds infant radio facilitates news gathering, as do many others in high public office.
Tom, what happened since we were last here?
Apparently, a lot of people on our subreddit were worried about Better Call Saul, because our top vote getter this week was the story that AMC has renewed Better Call Saul for a fourth season. Don't worry. It's coming back. We don't know when. We don't know when it goes into production, but it will get a fourth season.
Not that shocking. I mean,
Not
to me either. The third season was really, really good, and I loved every second of it. It left me wanting more, which is what I think you want out of a series like this. It would have been a real bummer if they would have said, sorry, that's it, you're only getting three, because so much stuff is unresolved. And I would just like to pause for a minute and realize or remind ourselves that I'm talking about a prequel here. So this is a show that comes before a show where we first meet Saul, where he was a kind of a throwaway character, not a throwaway character, but a character they, you know, made up for Breaking Bad. they've built all this backstory, and now I'm so invested. I so much need to know where we go next about a prequel of a character who I already know from a show.
Know where he ends up. Yeah, I know.
It's crazy.
Now, Dave, I have a question for you. This is pretty much your daily experience as a lawyer, right, in this series?
Yeah, roughly.
Like, this is all drawn from the typical lawyer experience, I'm sure.
Exactly. I mean, it's just nothing but hookers and blow and meth and et cetera, and crazy capers that you wouldn't believe, and a romance story that that no one can imagine and sometimes has its ups and downs.
Sure. I could totally see that. In a world where prequels usually leave me a little bummed out because I know where things end up, this show has magically figured a way to do that. I mean, like, I feel like prequel movies and TV shows could learn a lot from whatever's making this show run. And I don't know where this magic comes from or how they worked it out, but it's really amazing that way. Even when we see him, they've done two things, because every season starts with showing him post Breaking Bad in some situation. I don't want to give away what if you haven't seen the show. And then they kind of go back and tell all this stuff before Breaking Bad. So they've done it on two counts. I want to know how and why he is where he is in the current timeline. And then I'm dying to know how all the stuff gets resolved in the timeline they're telling in the show proper. And I want to know where all these characters end up that we don't have in Breaking Bad. There's only a few of them that we still have consistently. And that's been fun to watch, to see how they originated. Like, it really is a pretty special show, and I can't believe they've pulled it off. So thank you for season four. If that's all you got, you better finish it up nice and tight, because I need some closure on a few things. Let's just say brother stuff. I need to get that worked out. That's all I'll say. It's not a spoiler, is it?
Sounds dirty when you say it like that.
I promise it's not. Well, it's a little dirty, but not in the way you're thinking. It's, Anyway, good for them.
Let's talk about a dirty show, Game of Thrones.
Yeah.
Season 7 premieres July 16th, and the final episode of this shortened season will be 82 minutes long, and apparently that might be the norm in season 8. At Con of Thrones on July 1st, sound designer for Game of Thrones, Paula Fairfield, said the team is considering making each episode of the 6-episode 8th season feature length.
Wow, that's barely a short season, is it, then?
Yeah. Well, it's... It makes you wonder, like, would you be able to just break it up into 10 episodes then if you're going to shoot that much?
I think this is in line with Justin Robert Young's theory that the actors just kind of want to get out of here a little bit. Not that they don't love the work they've done or don't, you know.
It's just cold.
It's cold. The winter really is coming now. And, you know, you can only do that for so long. But, I after this many seasons, I think that they're all starting to find careers in other ways, potentially. They want to kind of get out of this typecasting, and this is a good way to do it. I'm totally cool with this. In fact, I would really look forward to a weekly television event that felt like a film every time. And I'm sure that if you went back, I'm sure they've got episodes that went that or longer just without being cut. So this is just them not having to cut as much.
Sometimes that makes for a bad episode. Mm. Like, cutting has its purpose, right? That's to keep pacing going and all of that. So, yeah.
What do you think, Dave? You think is this going to work for us? Are we okay with a movie every week?
I think so, because we're only talking about 6 episodes here. And if you look at what Game of Thrones has done recently with the grand epic scale, the last 2 episodes they put out, including Battle of the Bastards, most notably, those episodes, they flow well. There's not a lot of extra chaff. They got a lot of story left to tell. And I feel like that's really the driving force here, is they've got too many story bits that they want to get out that George R. R. Martin gave to them. And they have to get through as many of them as they can. So it just is going to necessitate longer episodes. I will say, in the story about this season, the finale is 82 minutes, but it's also going to have the shortest episode of the entire run at just under 50 minutes. Mm-hmm. I don't know when that comes, but, you know, I like that this show, just like everything else, it's not akin to any rules, right? It'll do whatever it wants to tell the story that it wants to tell.
Yeah, I guess that's a sign of what we're seeing. For sure.
Yeah, that's kind of the new norm now, with HBO pioneering it, I think, but Netflix picking up the torch as well, saying take as long as you need to tell your story. We don't have commercial breaks yet to
finish. Yeah, that's true. Also, Dave, what's your take on the idea of 5 potential spinoff sequel stuff things? Do you think that's too many? Like, as a fan of the show, do you feel like is that too much?
It probably is, but again, you might as well fish while you got all the lures in the world, and that's what HBO has with Game of Thrones right now. Yeah. Going back to Better Call Saul, I thought of the characters you could have picked from Breaking Bad, that was one of perhaps the worst, and I'm jaded because I'm an attorney, but I thought that was going to fail, and then they told a really good story. So I've got high hope. There's plenty of great things you can dive deep into that I'm interested in as a recent Game of Thrones fan. You know, I'll give them a try, and if HBO continues to get good writers and tell good stories, I don't think 5 is out of the realm. If 2 or 3 succeed, so be it.
Yeah, literally the realm. I like how you put that.
Yeah, it's not bad. Or all the 7 realms. Yeah. Hey, Nintendo Super NES Classic Edition will be launching September 29th. We got the date last week, didn't do a show, so we thought we'd talk about it this week. Miniature console, plays games over HDMI, uses 2 wired controllers, and comes with 21 classic games, including Donkey Kong Country, Final Fantasy III, The Legend of Zelda, Link to the Past, Star Fox, and Star Fox 2, which never was released.
Yeah.
Also, of course, Super Mario World, Super Mario Kart. Europeans will get a sleek, curved Japanese Super Famicom-looking design, while the U.S. will get the traditional purple boxy Super NES for $80.
I hope the controllers are just like the old ones, because they're one of the great, best solid-state controller designs of all time, and I'm pretty jazzed about it. We could go into all the issues of, will they have enough stock this time? The NES Classic sold out too quick and they quit making them. And
oh, yes, we will have that. I guarantee it.
There will be. Here's what I'm going to think they're going to do. This is my current thinking.
They're current geeking.
They're going to make this thing. They're going to sell like crazy. They're going to run out, but they'll have a little more on the back end for stock and they'll replenish those a bit. But they are not going to make this a perennial thing that's just in the store all the time. This is going to run out at some point and they're not going to make them anymore. And I think that's to their benefit. And as much as I hate the secondary market, eBay, black markety stuff that happens around limited quantity stuff like this and artificial shortages of things, I don't actually think it helps them in the long run to have these weird multiple SKUs on shelves. At the same time, they have their flagship products like the Switch and to a lesser extent, the 3DS. So my thinking is, yes, there'll be more this time around, but there will still be an end to that well, and it will not go on forever. Time will tell. But I'm excited about it. You know, once again, people would say, why would I pay for this when I can just retropie myself into oblivion and have every game ever made, and legal or not, why wouldn't I do that for less money? I would say you want one of these for all the factors that you want them for. The nostalgia, the fact that it's a Nintendo actual product. These are, you know, while they're still emulated, it's as close as you're ever going to get to the originals. And where else are you going to get Star Fox 2? That thing was never released. So, and as far as I know, never even pirated. In fact, now it will be. Someone will hack one of these.
Finally
we can hack Star Fox 2. Dave, are you stoked about another limited edition thing that Nintendo will just sort of dangle out in front of us and then take away just as quick?
Yes, I absolutely am. As the proud owner of an NES Classic somehow, and now a Switch, which was much more difficult than it needed to be to get my hands on. I think the most interesting part of the SNES Classic was the pitching of what curated games list we were going to get. And certainly, I think the list is very good. If I had my druthers, I would add things like Mortal Kombat and certainly Chrono Trigger. But there's a little bit of everything here, including Street Fighter II, which is the better, probably, fighting game. Plenty of RPGs on the system that kind of made RPGs what they are today.
Mm-hmm.
I don't think there's any complaints here, except if Star Fox 2 is just a bad, you know, Slippy Falco love story that we never knew about.
Oh, man, now you got me excited. Let me ask you this here's my first question about patent law. Ready? So
fire away.
Third parties in video games is always a thing, right? Trying to get third parties to develop for your system and so on. Here we have a retro machine, and there's a number of third-party titles here, mostly from traditionally close allies to Nintendo, Capcom, and a few others, like with Street Fighter. My question to you is, what do you think the reason is we don't have a sweat instead of blood Mortal Kombat port, or even an MK2 port, which actually did finally have blood in it? But some of those other third-party games, is it hard to negotiate these deals for classic games, or is that easier than I'm giving it credit for?
Well, it's all just a game about money when you're coming to the licensing table. And in fact, for certain things like Chrono Trigger, Nintendo has been able to get that on some of their virtual platforms, I believe. So it's not out of the question. It's just a matter of dollars and cents. And in the case of some companies, they certainly want to extract more for their big IPs like Mortal Kombat. And that could just be the issue here is they have a price point they want to stick to. They probably, it's at $80 instead of $60 because they probably had to pay some extra in licensing fees this time around. I think this was to be expected that you would have a slightly shorter list. And the games are a lot longer and a lot better on the 16-bit system than the 8-bit. So I think it was unrealistic to think we were going to get, you know, a Raspberry Pi-esque list of all the games. I just have my personal disappointments. I'm sure everybody else does.
Yeah, there's always going to be one or two or three of those in there. It's unfortunate, too, that the initiative isn't, hey, we'll let you download and pay for other classic games. I know they have an intent to do that on the Switch with a whole new service. And so, you know, obviously there's stuff.
That makes the product more complex, right? You have to build in connectivity. You have to build in a store. Mm-hmm. I think this is just classic Nintendo simplicity. 20 games that are 21 games, easy number, easy to wrap your head around. Not going to get lost and forget what's on there. We are going to make them from this date till this date. We think we can make a good enough amount of money to make this worth it to make this many. And that's how many we're going to make.
Yeah,
I think people misinterpret Nintendo all the time. Oh, it was an evil plan to cause shortages to get. They're going to sell a lot of these. No company doesn't want to sell its products. That's how they make their money unless it's on a different business model. But Nintendo just makes money off of selling these. But I just think it's kind of a Nintendo way of doing business saying, you know, we plan for this. And then if it runs, once it runs out, we're moving on to the next thing. So We won't go back and rev it up. They're just very rigid that way.
Yeah. Do you think we get an N64 classic at some point? Seems reasonable.
I wonder when. That's a good question.
Yeah.
I think we do, but I don't think it's going to be anywhere close to next year. I think we're a ways off from that being the retro thing. So we're probably 5 years away, I would guess.
N64. Yeah. And plus you're talking about up till now, the controllers that they include in this thing, well, thankfully this one has longer cords, 5 feet instead of 3 feet on the NES Classic. The controllers have been very accurate constructions of the previous the controllers that existed back then. So they've gone kind of out of their way to do that. I also think that's part of the reason for the price hike a little bit is they're, you know, we're talking about bigger, better hardware. However, the N64 controller, things get thrown out the door. Like that is straight up the weird thing from hell. It's like a giant plastic star with analog control thrown in and triggers, and that whole world was introduced then of all that extensive sort of controller change. And I don't know what that looks like in a classic edition. I don't know how, is it the same size? Is it exactly, do they have to follow suit and make it a perfect replica of the previous controllers? Games were bigger, not huge, but bigger. So
the problem becomes you can't just shrink the controller down and have it still work the same way.
Right. So I don't. So that's my big hangup. I don't know if they ever do it because of those reasons.
When the mini GameCube comes out, it gets even worse.
Mm-hmm. Also, you could argue the GameCube PS1 era, or not GameCube, sorry, N64 PS1 era is not that great. It's okay, but we were infancy polygon days. And while there are some definite classics, Mario 64, incredible game. But you could do enhanced versions of those games on the Switch and sell a crap ton of those without having to go through the trouble of making a bunch of new hardware.
Wait a minute.
Yeah.
Wasn't Ocarina of Time N64?
It was, and it looks, if you go look at it.
Wasn't GoldenEye N64?
Really ugly. Really ugly.
Yeah, well, all of these classic games are ugly. It's not about, I mean, it's nostalgia. It's of their time.
But here's my thing, and I realize this, I may be alone in this, but I've felt this way for a long time. We are nostalgic. And I don't think it's a generational thing. We are nostalgic for sprite-based art. I don't know anyone who's nostalgic for janky, crappy, low-resolution texture polygon.
Used to be nostalgic for sprite-based art.
No, but it always held up. It never
looked
bad.
This goes back
bad.
To Dave's point. It's going to have to be a while because you're going to have to wait until the audience gets old enough and the graphics get far enough where you're like kind of nostalgic for that old way of chunky 3D.
Yeah, but they were blurry and they were slow and the cameras were... I'm not convinced. I'm not convinced we ever get to a place where that stuff we get excited about. We get excited about vector. We get excited about sprites and we get excited about maybe...
We do now.
Yeah, but
time has gone by.
But nobody gets nostalgic for the look and I shouldn't say that because obviously
I bet
does.
You go back to 2001 and we find somebody saying exactly the same thing you're saying about 8-bit graphics.
Yeah, but does anyone say that about Atari graphics? No.
Yeah, they did.
Did they?
Atari graphics are atrocious.
Right. They're horrible. And that's my point.
I actually remember people saying like, oh, Atari, we used to think that was so good. Can you really believe that? How crappy it was?
Yeah. But there's something about 16-bit era and even 8-bit era, but more so 16, that is carried through. There are tons of new games now. You can buy, I can go to Steam right now and find 50 games, all in the style of a Super NES style. And they all look good. Like, they actually look good. They feel good. They look good.
I think it's just a matter of time. I think I think when they're close enough to what we're doing now that you can compare them, that's when they seem awful, right? Because you're like, you just need to do this, this, and this, and it'll look so much better. Once enough time has gone by, though, then it starts to be like, well, it's a style. It was the style in those days. You wore a leak on your chest, and we liked it.
Yeah. You know? Maybe we need to. We'll revisit this in 10 years, you and I.
Yeah.
Because I have.
Keep a note, chat room. Remind us in 10 years on July 7th, 2027, to revisit this topic.
Yes, indeed. Anyway, looking forward to the Super NES Classic and mainly the controllers, if I'm being honest. I can't wait for those.
And fighting with people in stores. Yes. Get your hands on one.
Yes. Oh, yeah.
That's the real game.
Yeah, those graphics never change. They're always high fidelity, so get ready for it. Going to take this moment to talk about SendPro from Pitney Bowes. You all love SendPro from Pitney Bowes. I know I do. They have 3 times the features of Stamps.com at 1/3 the price. I cannot emphasize that enough. You print stamps from your own computer. You save time and money. No special equipment necessary. No more waiting in line at the post office. No software to install. Just works right there in your web browser. That's key for me. Compare shipping rates and delivery times between USPS and other major carriers to ensure you're always getting the best deal when you ship packages. Print paid shipping labels for USPS, UPS, and more. Track those shipments using those same easy-to-use interfaces right there on your web browser. Piece of cake. Pitney Bowes has made some great negotiations to get you special rates, saving you up to 3 cents per stamp. It's crazy. And even businesses can mail now and pay later. They have flexible payment options. So I want you guys to do a thing and save some money, okay? pb.com/geek. Go there. You're going to learn more about all this stuff. And when you sign up, you get SendPro for free for 90 days. And you get a 10-pound scale for free. And when that trial's over, you get SendPro for only $5 a month. That's a special rate good for the lifetime of your SendPro subscription. So that's $5 a month for SendPro versus $15.99 a month for Stamps.com. That is 3 times the features, 1/3 the price, $5 a month, and you'll never have to visit that post office again. Time is money, and that's a great business investment. But you can only get this deal for a limited time by going to pb.com/geek. That's pb.com/geek. We thank Pitney Bowes for sponsoring this episode of Current Geek. And remember, when you support our sponsors, you're supporting this podcast.
All right. You guys ready to be bored?
Yep.
Elon Musk announced that the Boring Company completed the first segment of a tunnel in Los Angeles as part of a proposed network that would run from LAX to Sherman Oaks, California, right along the 405 freeway. Make it easy to get down to LAX if you're Elon Musk. Although the exact length and location has not been revealed yet, so the final plans aren't there. Company also said its first car pod elevator should be operational now. They said next week.
Wow.
So I haven't heard if it's operational yet, but last week they said next week. So that's the thing that, and the idea with this is they're going to build these tunnels under LA. You drive your car to this elevator and it gets put on a pod, goes down into the tunnel, and then the car is whisked along by the pod, which is on a track, and can go like 130 miles an hour.
Dude is serious about doing what he says he's going to do. That guy.
He sure is.
Yeah. So you're in LA. No guesses locally where somebody thinks this tunnel is?
Well, yeah, LAX to Sherman Oaks, but we don't know the exact route or anything yet.
She's like tempted to go over there and just see if we can just, you know.
You know, I do have a friend who works at SpaceX where they started drilling this thing. So
I don't know why that's so interesting to me, but
yeah.
Yeah. Dave, you excited? We're going to start running through tubes, Futurama style, sort of, kind of, not really.
Well, he's done a lot with rockets, so I give him credit. Like you said earlier, he might be boring his way through the Earth right now, but I give him credit. He does do what he sets his mind to. I have my doubts just because legality wise, there's a lot of things you have to do when you're boring through the earth and digging. You have to worry about utilities and all that. And I know they're trying to get the permits and go through that process. But if you're going underneath a major city, going underneath LAX or something, there's a lot of risk factor there. And I just wonder if this is going to be a bad version of a subway system, right? Because many subway systems have been abandoned in some major cities, and this could be another version of that. And that's my worry.
Yeah.
Well, the good news about LA is we have a subway system, and despite its sinkhole back in 1990, when did Waterworld come out?
95.
So the sinkhole happened the week Waterworld came out.
Perfect.
When they were digging the first line. But yeah, despite that early problem, the subways have been drilled quite well here. So it's possible to do it right. You just got to, like you say, you got to watch out for electrical lines, and you got to be earthquake safe, and you got to not disturb the mole men who live deep below the earth, and you'll be fine.
Yep. I love that it's the Boring Company, by the way. It's the best thing ever. Should
I
always
see this as a path to us having the Ghostbusters slime river, right? Oh. That's where he's boring to. So we can have that.
Yeah.
That's probably the real reason.
And wasn't that I hate Ghostbusters too, but wasn't that the idea is that was an abandoned subway system or part of an abandoned stuff? I love the idea of abandoned subway systems. Or
me too. I don't know what it is.
That's weird. Like or cities on top of cities.
I love old abandoned stuff.
Yeah. Speaking of abandoning things, and this is all tied back in together, can we just have a moment of silence for all the seasons Fox owns of Futurama being taken off Netflix? A little bit of a bummer.
Oh, everybody's freaking out. You know what? Shows get taken off Netflix all the time, and then they show up somewhere else. It's going to be fine. Everybody just relax.
I hate it. I want them back. I mean, what's weird is that because Cartoon Network or Comedy Central or whoever owns the latter seasons, the new ones, the widescreen ones, those are all still there because they still
have
a deal.
You know what I just realized is a likelihood here, because Viacom has also been pulling their channels off of various streaming services. I think they're on DirecTV now, but that's about it.
Yeah.
I wonder if Viacom's going to be launching their own service where they're like, hey, we've got all the seasons of Futurama, all our channels, all our shows on demand, and you pay us $10 a month, you get it all.
Yeah, I wonder. I don't know. But if that's true, then the Comedy Central seasons are still on Netflix. It's the Fox-produced ones that are off. So maybe they're... I don't know if they can even control all of it.
No, you're right. That's reverse of what it would be if my theory held true.
True, but it's just such a bummer.
Maybe Fox is going to put them on FX.
Yeah, maybe. Maybe this whole unplugger thing is just a nightmare. Maybe we should have done it.
It's not a nightmare. No, it's all about expectations. You actually have more choice and control, and everything is more available. It's just that people are like, yeah, but I didn't have to think before.
Yeah.
I didn't have to make any choices before. And yet you didn't have as much control, and you complained about that. You've just traded up to a different kind of complaint.
I totally agree. It's just such a great show, and it's important around here. We watch it all the time. So wherever it ends up, I'm sure I'll gravitate over there and get it. Speaking of a show that has New York.
Everything goes in cycles.
Yeah, right? And their entire city of New York is built upon, the whole point of me getting to this was it's built on old New York. So old New York is down there where all the mutants are now.
Oh, right. Yeah, all the mutants live downstairs.
Yeah, and I love that. For whatever reason, that concept works for me.
Futurama didn't used to be on Netflix.
No.
Then it came to Netflix. Now it's gone from Netflix. It may return again someday.
Right.
Just like Jonathan Frakes. Used to direct things for Star Trek. Then he didn't direct things for Star Trek. And now he's directed things for Star Trek again. He's going to direct an episode of Star Trek Discovery.
Whoa.
He has in the past done Next Generation, Deep Space Nine, Voyager, First Contact, mm-hmm. and Insurrection.
Mm-hmm.
He doesn't just do Star Trek. He's also directed episodes of Agents of S.H.I.E.L.D., NCIS LA, V, Roswell, bunch of other stuff. So how do you feel getting... Riker back behind the camera
to where he belongs. Well, I mean,
I know you didn't mean that as mean as a camera.
Yeah, I didn't exactly mean it that way. I mean, I love Frakes. I think he's great as both Riker and director. He's done a good job. Like First Contact's one of the best Star Trek movies ever made. Insurrection's a really good 2-hour episode of Star Trek. Not necessarily a great movie, but you know, whatever. It's fine. It was still good for what it was. And I think this is exciting. This feels like not just a stunt, because he knows his stuff and he's respected for it. So it's a great way to tie old Star Trek in with new Star Trek and make us all kind of feel a little bit better about that. Dave, where's your head on the whole this whole Discovery thing? Are you feeling good about it? And does this news do anything to your thinking?
All right. So sorry, podcast listeners, but I'm holding up a shirt for Scott and Tom. Turns out I'm number one, and I think this is a number one move by the people running Discovery. You need that tie back to the old Roddenberry days, and this is a perfect call to do it, because Jonathan has actually done a lot of directing in the last, especially, 5 years, and I think he's refined his art a lot. If you look back at his Star Trek episodes, they aren't really all that great. I mean, highlighted by Sub Rosa, which is just awful all around.
I forgot TNG. That's his. That's the one with the old lady ghost and stuff.
It is.
Oh, it's so bad. It's so bad.
But we will forgive him for that, because the movies he did were okay.
He didn't write it.
No. Well, that. Yeah. That's no, true. I mean, the right. Yeah. Maybe blame the writing, but oof, man.
Yeah.
But,
yeah.
But I think they're putting together a good team of writers, a good team of differing directors. And I look at other series that have done well, like Game of Thrones, and they're doing a similar thing. So I think this is a natural move, and just one of the things that I almost expected when Discovery was announced. It gives me high hopes. I don't know that episode is going to be, you know, the greatest thing this season, because he doesn't have all the control in the world. But this is a nice tie back for those of us Trek fans who have, you know, been living on since Riker was lifting his leg over chairs.
Do you think he still does that when he directs? He just lifts it over.
Oh, I think there's going to be an entire ship of people who do that in his episode.
Oh, I love it. Aliens that just do that.
That's their thing.
They all have beards. You're ruining me here. I want this.
And Riker's dad will be on first contact with that race. And that's how it's introduced.
Thank goodness. And maybe his brother, was it Thomas he played? Where he was the twin?
Oh, yeah. The transporter twin.
Teleporter twin that turned out to be kind of a jerk. Yeah. I want that guy back too.
They're always jerks. Every twin is always a jerk.
You're not
tell
wrong.
Tell Bill Duran that.
Yeah. Tell the Bill Duran that. But don't do it while I'm around. He'll explode. Well, there you go. Well, well done and good, all of these stories. And many of them, if not all of them, were submitted by our subredditors. Tom, who do we have to thank this week?
Well, this week, Strike at Ritwan, Captain Kipper, I Am Sci-Fi, and Hometown Rival all submitted stories that were used on the show at currentgeek.reddit.com. You can do the same and vote on the stories as well. We don't thank all the people who voted for these stories that were submitted by these folks, because without your votes, they wouldn't be considered.
Yeah. Rock the vote. Get out the vote, as the kids say.
Yeah. Eat the vote.
Eat the vote, everybody. Eat the vote. Okay. Real quick, before we jump into our next segment, I want to thank our friends over at HelloFresh at HelloFresh.com. They are the meal delivery kit service that makes cooking more fun, so you can focus on the whole experience, not just the final plate. Every week, HelloFresh.com creates new delicious recipes with step-by-step instructions, and each recipe is designed to take around 30 minutes. You make it in your own kitchen. They're set up so anybody can make a delicious and nutritious meal all by yourselves or with friends. I guess you can do it with each other. And you do it in like 30 minutes or less. So whether you usually cook for yourself or, I don't know, even if you're not so comfortable with it, but you love a good home-cooked meal, man, these guys are the best for that. HelloFresh sources the freshest ingredients measured to the exact quantities needed, so there is no food waste, and everything is delivered to your doorstep in a recyclable, insulated box. They are now offering light spring meals as well, and just introduced breakfast options, which is pretty great. That's less than $10 a meal. That's crazy. I have teamed up over here on Current Geek with HelloFresh.com, and they're offering everyone in our audience 30% off your first week of deliveries when you go to HelloFresh.com and use the offer code CURRENTGEEK30. I just received new meals in the mail myself yesterday. I cannot wait to eat them. I forget which ones I got this week, but I'm stoked to dive in. In fact, I think today is our first one. I'll let you know next week what I think. But I love them. I've always enjoyed them. You will too. That's HelloFresh.com and the offer code CURRENTGEEK30 to get $30 off your first week of deliveries. Huge thanks to HelloFresh.com.
America scores and wins.
All right. You know what that means. It's time for the pop quiz, everybody. The pop quiz, where we give a chance for our guests, in this case, guest, to answer questions in his area of expertise. When he gets an answer right, you're going to hear this. When he gets it wrong, you'll certainly hear this. Tom will keep score, and at the end, we'll see how he did.
Mm-hmm.
Dave, you know the rules. You've heard the show plenty of times. Are you ready for your category, sir?
I am hopelessly ready.
Here it is. For Dave Fitzgerald, today's category is Risk, the board game Risk. Quick story about Risk. I have a friend who was playing Risk. Wasn't playing Risk. Was out goofing around with fireworks. set a huge field on fire with his friends. Ended up getting controlled and okay. Nobody got hurt. Nobody's house burned down. But it was kind of a gnarly deal for a bit. Once they realized the fire was out of control and there was nothing they could do, they all ran in the house, tore the risk board off the shelf, laid it out, put pieces everywhere. So when the police came, they claimed that they were playing Risk the whole time and had no idea what was going on outside. So there you go. A little Risk story for you. Don't do
that's
it, kids.
That's a risky lie.
It really is a risky lie. I don't think those adults were that stupid. I think they kind of knew what was going on. But anyway.
As the legal correspondent, I approve of that storytelling.
It's a pretty great story. Anyway, let's get to it. Here's your first question. What year was the game Risk first released?
Ooh, it's an old game. We're going to go with 1923.
You are incorrect. It was 1957, actually. 57.
Wow, not that old.
Not as right. old as you or I thought.
I'm going to give a third of a point for being in the right century.
All right, look at that. See, Tom will help you out when you need it most. Here's your next question. What French film director created Risk? I did not know this, by the way. This is great.
Patrick Beja.
French film directors for 1,000, Alex.
No kidding.
Yeah, I don't know. I'm going to put my thinking cap on and just say I don't know.
You have a thinking cap? Oh, you're going to get points for that for sure. Tom,
he is correct. He does not know.
I forgot Tom has controls now. Albert Lamorisie, I think is how you say it. Was the guy
Lemorsay?
I bet Patrick
will come in and say, "No, that is not how you say it." Yeah. Neither of you are right.
Yeah,
I bet Dan Patrice knows that.
He probably does, because Dan Patrice knows a lot of things.
He sure does.
Next question: how many territories are there in the game?
Do the math in my head. There's 7 and 11 and 5 and so on and so forth. We'll take a stab at this and say 43.
Oh, he's so close. 42 is the answer.
Oh, 9/10 of a point.
Oh, that was really intense. Man, when as soon as you said 40, I was like, he's going to get it. And then you're one up.
I should have known. It's the number that means everything.
Yeah, that's exactly. It's the answer to all the questions.
Yeah, when in doubt.
Duh. All right, here's your next question. What year was Risk inducted into the Game Magazine's Hall of Fame?
I was going to say, you're just repeating the question one again.
That word jumped out at me.
We'll,
but so
we'll
it was
go 1923 again. No, of course not. We'll go 1985 on that.
Oh, man. 1 year off again. 1984 is the correct
9/10 of a point.
Oh, he's so close. Just targeting right in there. All right. Final question. We have a little surprise at the end of this, but anyway, according to the original game box, how many players can play a game of Risk?
6.
I'm going to say yes. The actual answer is 2 to 6, but 6 being the top.
Yeah,
I think
that is an acceptable answer.
Yeah, totally. Now, normally we have a second guest. We don't today. Instead, I'm going to ask Tom the questions we were going to ask of our other guest, so we don't waste these. And that was in the category.
And as the only accredited scorekeeper, I will, of course, fairly assess my own points. Is that how this works?
Yeah, we believe you. We trust you. It's going to be fine. Your topic, Tom, is Rush trivia, the band, not the sensation, okay, or the traffic or any of that. The band.
Can I phone a friend?
You cannot phone a friend. Although you can phone Dave here if you
All
want.
All right, good.
Yeah, you guys can work together on this if you want. Here is your first question. How many studio albums have been released by the band Rush?
23.
Dave, do you have a guess?
We'll play this like Stump Dunaway. I'll go higher.
You're going to say higher. The answer is lower. 19 is the correct answer. 19.
Oh, man. Ah. How will I ever get my copy of Red Dragon now?
23 is the new 19. I read that in a fashion magazine.
I have one right here for you, buddy. You can just come get this copy. I have too many of these already. I've got like 5 of these. Ibbit has like 20 of them. Anyway, next up. How long is the first side of Rush's 2112 album?
21 minutes and 12 seconds.
Oh, do you want to modify that at all, Dave?
Nope. I think that's fine.
20 minutes, 32 seconds. Real close.
Well, they missed an opportunity. They're wrong.
They are kind of wrong. I'm going to agree with you.
That's at least 9/10 of a point.
Yep.
Yeah.
I'm going to give you you should have a yes for that. what year was Rush's album Moving Pictures released?
1978.
Okay. Dave, any closer, higher, lower?
I think it's earlier than that.
You are both wrong. It is 1981 is the correct answer.
Oh, crap.
Yeah. That album was big
deal. In Greenville, we were always 3 years behind.
You get Unleaded Gas after everybody. You guys had Temple of Doom in 1988. Yeah, I understand. My wife's from Mississippi. She felt your pain. What does YYZ in the song YYZ refer to?
Toronto Airport.
Any? What do you think?
Oh, I'll buy that.
You're both correct. Well done. It has to do with the Toronto Pearson International Airport. It is the IATA identification for it. Mm-hmm. It's really weird. All right, final question. Who was the original drummer for Rush and eventually got replaced by Neil Peart?
George W. Bush.
Former president or a different one? Okay. Dave?
I will amend his answer to Dave Grohl.
All right. Let's. About 20 years too early. John Rutsey, R-U-T-S-E-Y, is the original drummer for Rush. I probably should have known that because I saw a documentary about that guy. Anyway, well done. You both helped each other do something. Tom, how did you both do? And
well, I got 4 points, but missed that last one about the drummer. So Dave wins with 4.1.
Yeah, well done, Dave. Nicely done, sir. Wait, there's the music. Yeah. Well done. You've made us all proud. And your parents, too. Let's get to forecast.
The future promises even more startling things to come.
All right. I'm always excited when one of our guests has the forecast for today. And the way forecast works is we try to predict the future in technology and pop culture and comics. Whatever it is, we do it. I don't know why I said comics. Dave, you swooped in with one. Explain yourself. What's your prediction for the future?
Well, I figured you guys would be tired after Nerdtacular, and I was trying to think of what the next form of Nerdtacular is going to be. We obviously had that discussion, or you had that discussion at the convention.
Yep.
So my prediction is this. I think within 20 years, VR and headsets will become just as much a part of our lives as smartphones are now. I think the leading edge of that is going to be the business functions, kind of like how we're using Skype for business and things now. That's going to lead the charge. And eventually, it's going to make hosting a Nerdtacular or a BlizzCon or any of those conventions that are really hard to get to and cost prohibitive for some people, an experience that everyone can obtain and enjoy. And the plus side as well is that no con crud or travel woes, as I experienced with food poisoning 3 days ago.
That's a bummer. Wait, where did you get it? Do you know? You didn't get it at Snowbird, I hope.
No, I got it from, I believe, and I don't want to, I guess, disparage their name, but I'm pretty sure I got it from Yeti Pizzeria in downtown Salt Lake.
So. Oh, no. Oh, man. I hate hearing when somebody came here and got like hosed on food. It makes me feel bad.
The pizza was fantastic, though. So make sure you go to Yeti. Just maybe skip the wings.
You think it was the wings. All right. Oh, man. I was thinking, you know what? It's funny. No Nerdtacular goes by without some weird thing like that. This year, it was you, and then we had somebody with a very rare altitude thing that ended up putting her in the ER for 2 days, in ICU for 2 days. She's good now. She's back in Oregon, and everyone's happy, and she's doing great, and they got her all the treatment she needed. But yeah, once in a while, one of these happens, and I have this personal psychological problem where I take it on myself to feel bad and take it like it's my fault. So on behalf of my state of bad wings, I apologize for your food poisoning that you experienced while you're here.
Now, in the future, when we have this virtual conference that avoids any kind of wing disaster or altitude sickness, will we all come away with pink eye?
Absolutely.
Well, I mean, if we're all have our own, hopefully we're not sharing as much, you know, like. Right now, I don't want to go to a public place
See,
where...
that's how this happens, right? You're like, hey, are you going to the VR Nerdtacular? Ah, I can't. I don't have a VR unit or mine's broken. Well, come on over. You can use mine and we'll be there together.
Yeah, pink eye everywhere. You're not wrong. I worry about that stuff. But hopefully we'll be in a place where that stuff's easier or self-cleaning or who knows. I don't know. And also, I mean, I'm still convinced. Like, I got to use a HoloLens at the event. Somebody brought one.
Is that where I got the pink eye?
Maybe. Might have been. He very purposely showed me clean. He showed himself cleaning it before I got up there. Yeah, he was like, now notice I'm using ibuprofen alcohol here. Yeah. Anyway, I put that thing on, and I came away convinced that once they get the field of view thing figured out, because right now it's way too narrow, that really is probably the future of this stuff.
No, because the placement on the wall, you did the same one I did, I think, yeah. Right? With the aliens breaking through the wall.
Mm-hmm.
Like, it really was on the wall. Yeah. Like, I stopped thinking about, oh, well, that's just a picture over the wall. Like, the entire room became virtual.
Yeah, it was super impressive.
Oddly enough.
Yeah.
And so I would actually get jarred a little when I'd see real people. Like, whoa, oh, yeah, right. No, I'm still looking at the actual room.
Sure.
But yeah, it was the field of view was the only thing that took you out of it.
Yeah, so at some point, you know, these are going to be smaller. They'll be attached in ways that maybe aren't even on your eye, so pink eye won't be the big issue. Who knows, maybe they're implants, but I was so impressed.
Well, maybe they'll come up with green eye and blue eye, and then the PRG can create the images.
There you go. Well done. Whatever they do, that's the future. But it just won't be looking through everything like it's a postage stamp. Way too limited view there.
I mean, it's bigger than a postage stamp, but yeah. There's
like
no peripheral vision. You have to be looking directly at whatever it is that you want to see.
Yeah. Imagine postage stamps are 16:9. Ratio. That's what that was.
Yeah.
Like.
These are, it's the 4x3 world, not the 16:9 wraparound.
Exactly. World. But once they get it and it's full field of view or something close to it, all bets are off. That stuff's really awesome. Super, super impressed with it.
Right. And if you push back 15 or 20 years to the smartphone industry, which is kind of where this idea generated from, I mean, we're looking at small flip phone screens or even, you know, smaller and more digitized than that. And just to think how far those have come, even in just the last decade, the mm-hmm. iPhone era, I think all this push for VR and more immersive experiences, these are the things that hopefully make our convention going and gatherings something that we can be more accessible to. All that being said, I do think there's still going to be a place for, you know, shaking hands and being in person, obviously.
Sure.
But I just think this makes it more accessible, and that's going to be one of the big tech pushes for the next year.
Sure. Even if you look at it, like you brought up BlizzCon here, and Nerdtacular would be another good example of this, but even if it was just, hey, we're at a place where things are being shown on a stage, or things are being demonstrated in a way that would really benefit from people walking around in that space virtually, that's huge. And it could even still cost, what do they charge, Tom, for the home things? Like $49 for the BlizzCon home package. If you can't go, you watch it all on DirecTV.
Yeah, yeah, something like that. I don't know what they've been charging lately, but yeah. that's about right.
And charge for me to walk around there in a virtual way. I would pay for that. I would totally pay for that.
And then there would be the virtual room
mm-hmm.
Where no physical beings are allowed.
Right.
You can only go in virtually.
Yeah, I mean, the only thing I don't like about this crazy future is that I'm going to be old when it's really, like, super refined. Like, that's.
I mean, I don't know. Okay, I've got a realistic pocket television circa 1981-ish.
Good Lord, look at that.
That thing is the same size as my iPhone.
Okay.
On the width and height, but check out the depth between those two. It's like, I want to say four times the thickness, maybe five.
Yeah. Is it black and white or color?
It's black and white, okay. Too, yeah.
Yeah. So, and the screen's like the size of an old Game Boy, original Game Boy
screen.
Oh,
yeah. No, the screen is the size of my thumb.
How many batteries went in that thing?
You know what? That's a good question. It took four AAAs.
Oh, my Lord. And they were probably burned out by the time you got halfway through a Seinfeld episode or whatever.
Or, yeah, the baseball game that you were watching out while you're camping.
I loved those then, though. I thought they were so forward-thinking and so cool. And you're right. We're on this great track very quickly, and things seem to be speeding up. I just want to be there, and I don't want to be a decrepit old fart when it happens. I want to be wearing it.
Well, yeah, maybe medical technology will speed up, too.
Maybe. There's a lot of maybes, though.
Well, and if you're an old fart who can't walk around, the thing you want is the VR ticket, right? Because then you can walk around.
Yeah, but I don't want it to be dominated by a bunch of douchebag kids. You know, you're all just in there going, look, there's another old man here, but maybe in my VR space I can be as cool and whatever.
Yeah, they won't know.
Yeah.
You'll be walking around being a douchebag kid. Nobody will know you're an old fart.
85-year-old in this room in his dirty underwear playing VR games. Great. Well, anyway, well done, Dave. That's a good prediction. I think it's right on.
We brought this lovely vision of the future out of your otherwise perfectly normal prediction, Dave. Apologies.
Well, you know, we all got pink eye from this, so
yeah.
Congratulations.
We all got a little virtual pink eye together.
The Pink Eye Podcast.
We also have some feedback here. We got an email. These come to us at currentgeek@gmail.com. This came to us from somebody named Clipper7, which sounds like a animal who's the seventh one in a series of movies called Clipper. But anyway, says this: "Hey guys, is there a Star Wars character you'd like to see explored in a standalone movie that's not already announced?" Says Clipper 7. So we got Han Solo coming up. We got a Boba Fett movie rumored to be close behind.
Rumors of an Obi-Wan out there, maybe. Right.
I feel like every time I do this kind of thinking, I want to pull from extended fiction that's no longer canon potentially.
But well, and you could do that, right? I mean, they could do a Thrawn movie theoretically. They've done a book now that's canon,
and now he's in Rebels,
and he's
as
in
well.
Star Wars Rebels,
right? If I had to pick one though from the more standard grouping, maybe one of the other pilots or something from Episode 4, maybe Wedge or
Snap
maybe
Wexley.
Yeah, why not?
Oh wait, he's Episode 7. Never mind.
How about Porkins? A whole movie about Porkins.
The Porkins story.
I would watch that.
Why was he called Porkins? We can find that out and more.
Yeah.
I've got a little recency bias here, but as much as I didn't like Rogue One, and apologies to everybody in the audience not named Justin Robert Young, because I know that's a minority opinion.
Yeah.
But the blind character and his mate, I want to see a movie about them. I think that would be incredible.
Yeah, they were really interesting.
Chirrut. Dude, something
is that his name? I don't remember. Chim Chim Charu, that was it.
Yeah, they all died at the end, so we didn't care to remember their names.
That's right. But they were
spoiler.
The Force is with me.
Exactly, they were really interesting for sure. There's also some characters in the Old Republic that are explored through the various Old Republic games, including their online game, that could be fun to flesh those out and see more about their origins or their exploits. I don't know. It's hard to call. I feel like the obvious ones are already rumored or being made. And
I want to hear the origin of the Republic, the origin of the Jedi. But if I had to pick a character, the one that popped to mind unbidden before I even got a chance to really think about it was Ahsoka Tano.
Oh, wow. All right. That's pretty cool. I like maybe more background on, speaking of Rogue One, the what's his name?
Ricky Gervais?
No, yeah, Ricky Gervais, that famous Star Wars character. They call him Gervais. No, it was Guerrera. What's his name?
Saw Gerrera.
Saw Gerrera. That's it.
Yeah,
he's got stories to tell. You know he does. So that
There is his beginnings. His young days are in the Clone Wars.
Yeah,
and then we see kind of a middle aged version of him at the beginning of Rogue One, and apparently they shot more of him at that stage. But then we mostly in the final cut only see him as an old man.
How about a Hutt mobster movie about the Hutts?
Well, there's a couple of Clone Wars episodes that kind of fit that, so yeah, you could pull from that mythology and make a I mean that is one of the things I would like to see Lucasfilm loosen up and do, especially after they've done with 7, 8, 9. Mm-hmm. is just go further afield, show us something that isn't related to the mainline plot at all. It doesn't have one of the characters that are main to the saga and is just off in a corner of the universe.
How Lobot got his implants.
That is covered in the Lando Calrissian comics.
Oh, is it?
Yeah.
How he got them, really? Okay.
Yeah.
Damn it.
It shows Lobot before he had the implants and when he can talk.
Oh, so he had words to say before? Oh, yeah, I gotta read that.
A little jabber bot. Well, he wasn't a bot. He was just talkative.
Yeah. Now he's half... Well, he's Lobot now.
Oh, he's gossiping.
Standing around the water cooler wasting corporate time. I know.
He was low gossip back then.
He needed to be, we need to be pushing more gas, they'd say. And he'd say, I'm bored. And then he got operated on. And that's the story of Lobot. Hey, there you go, Clipper 7. We hope you've enjoyed our our horrible massacring of who should be in the next movie. But it is exciting to think of where they could pull from. And maybe I just.
Also, everybody's talking about Mara Jade in the chat room. I just don't want anyone to think we didn't consider.
Oh,
that. Yes,
sure.
Mara
yeah,
Jade
of course.
Too,
She's always a thing. I mean, if you ended up with something where, I mean, her and Thrawn in the same 2-hour movie would be pretty cool.
Yeah.
You could do a lot there. Timothy Zahn's got a lot of really cool characters that we could pull from. So we probably should mention him. And then also, why not an original thing? I know that's weird, but Rogue One was kind of original and it did well. Why not another original story? It doesn't have to be, hey, let's look at the backstory of something we already know.
They yeah, go yeah, just tell else. It like, off on Kessel somewhere.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. At some point, Disney has to go to that, though, right? If they're making movies every year, they're going to have to start telling original stories.
Yeah. Well, eventually they run out. So Yeah. And then you start asking, though, why don't I just have a really cool TV show? And
how maybe Yoda that... learned to cook.
Yeah. Mine this is. All right. Let's move on. Oh, and by the way, that email again is currentgeek@gmail.com. It's going to do it for the show. What a fine episode this was. It was a fantastic experience having you here, Dave, and not just a footnote on the end of the episode. There's still going to be one, though, today, so everybody keep listening. You'll hear it at the tail end. Please tell people more about where they can find you online or connect with you or whatever you'd like. What do you got?
Well, the primary place to find me online and on almost every platform is at Buckeye Fitzy. And yes, that is Buckeye as in the Ohio State and Fitzy, F-I-T-Z-Y.
Nice.
But pretty much everything I do is on Twitter. As far as projects that I can pimp, I'm in the middle of what I call summer convention educational speaking season. So our firm did sponsor Nerdtacular. I didn't speak there, but I do give speeches at game conventions for tabletop game designers. So we did Origins a few weeks ago, and I will be at Gen Con. So if you're interested in hearing me actually talk about patent and trademark law that doesn't bore you to tears, please feel free to look us up and find our presentations there in Indianapolis next month. Obviously, I do a bunch of podcast segments as well. You can find my work here pretty much every week on Legal Geek. If you have anything you want me to talk about, please send in suggestions. And character insight on Daryl's show this week in Trek.
Oh, wow. All right. And also, can I just say, you sound like you might work at the coolest law firm ever, because they're having you go to tabletop conventions and speak. Like, that is so cool. I mean, is it... did you bring all these initiatives there, or did they see it in you and want to exploit that? Like, I'm really curious about that.
No, I brought it. I was already attending Origins, and I wanted to attend Gen Con, and I realized seeing seminars there that there just weren't people educating game designers, and it's kind of an underserved field. And we don't get a lot of chance to do pro bono work in my field. I work for a lot of corporations because that's what patent attorneys do, because it's an expensive business. So every little bit I can do to help the field that I'm passionate about in my free time, which is gaming, grow, is great. And I've made a lot of, you know, good game designer friends and people like Dan Patrice. It's been rewarding. And the firm, I think, has benefited a little bit from it, maybe not as much as they paid for me to go to conventions and sponsor them. But, you know, that comes with time as well. And I think it's been a good foot forward.
That's really cool. I love that. It just feels like it's so far afield from the stereotype of what a patent lawyer and what a patent law is. I don't know. I feel like you just brought something new to it. So well done, I guess. That's really cool. And it was great to see it in Nerdtacular. Thanks for coming to that.
Yep. Always have had a great time.
Tom, any final closing words? Anything you want to talk about?
Just a reminder, if people haven't heard, I've started a writing Patreon. So if you're interested in the stories I tell, you can get first access to them. Up there right now is an audio clip of a story that I've been working on right now. So you can listen to that, and there'll be more to that story as it goes along. Also, if you back at the $5 level, you get to be one of the beta readers. So when I have a book that's actually ready to be sent to the editor, you'll get to look at it too and give feedback if you want. There'll be one of those coming soon, so you might want to sign up. Patreon.com/AceDetect.
Very nice. For the rest of you wondering what's going on with me, you can just find everything at frogpants.com. The Nerdtacular site there, which is linkable there, it's also at nerdtacular.com, has links to all the raw video from Nerdtacular and cool stuff there. Plenty of other stuff to check out there, so do check it out. Current Geek is our website. Another fine place to go. That's going to do it for us, for me, for Tom, and our guest. We'll see you next time.
Hi, and welcome back to Legal Geek. This week, we review the biggest Supreme Court trademark decision of the term. In the Lanham Act that defines federal trademark rights in the United States, Section 2 defines a series of grounds upon which a trademark application can be refused registration. One of these grounds is if the trademark consists of matter which may disparage or falsely suggest a connection with persons, living or dead, institutions, beliefs, or national symbols, or bring them into contempt or disrepute. In other words, offensive and disparaging trademarks can be denied registration under this so-called disparagement clause. This clause has been in effect for over 70 years, as it was in the original 1946 Lanham Act. As you'll recall, both the Washington Redskins football franchise and the Asian rock band The Slants were fighting separate high-profile court battles to contest the constitutionality of this disparagement clause. The Slants are comprised of Asian Americans, and while their band name is a derogatory term towards their race, They chose that band name to reclaim the term and drain any denigrating force it had over people of their race. Simon Tam, a singer in the band, and lead plaintiff in this case, was denied federal trademark registration based on the disparagement clause of the Lanham Act. Despite presenting boatloads of survey evidence and arguments to try and convince the examining attorney at the trademark office that there was no disparaging effect, but quite the opposite, the trademark application was always denied. By the time this case reached the higher courts, the key issue became whether the ban on disparaging trademarks is constitutional, or a violation of First Amendment free speech rights. Although the final opinion is complicated, with many concurring opinions, the primary part of the Supreme Court decision was a unanimous 8-0 decision in favor of striking this disparagement clause as an unconstitutional violation of First Amendment rights. The government tried to argue that trademarks are government speech, which is not subjected to First Amendment scrutiny. The court disagreed, determining that trademarks are definitely private speech because if the whole register of trademarks were considered government speech, the government would be babbling prodigiously and incoherently, according to Justice Alito's opinion. In short, if a limited government approval process were enough to convert private speech to government speech, this would be a dramatic expansion of items not covered by free speech protection, including potentially all copyright registrations. That's not a step the Supreme Court was comfortable with, for obvious reasons. Unlike the rest of the trademark refusal grounds in Section 2 of the Lanham Act, which are viewpoint neutral and are based on things relating to consumer confusion as to the source of goods, aka the entire point of trademark law, the disparagement clause discriminates based on particular viewpoints. It does not fit with the rest of trademark law, and it violates the First Amendment in the court's judgment. So this part of the Lanham Act is now gone after 70 years. The victory for free speech may result in some nasty word and phrase trademarks in the future, but it's a win for the Redskins and the Slants all the same. That same section of the Lanham Act also bans immoral and scandalous marks from registration, but this also seems to be inconsistent with the rest of trademark law, and it will likely go down as unconstitutional in parallel cases ongoing now. The bottom line is, the disparagement clause and other offensive mark refusals were always tough for trademark office examining attorneys to judge, and this ruling should bring clarity as examiners focus more on consumer confusion and the core tenets of trademark law rather than whether something may be offensive. Even if free speech protection allows a few bad apple disparaging marks to be registered in the future, consumers can always vote with their wallets to effectively reject the use of such trademarks in commerce. Thanks for listening. Please provide feedback and segment suggestions to me on Twitter at BuckeyeFitzy.
This show is part of the Frog Pants Network.
Frog Pants Network.
Get more shows like this at frogpants.com.